Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm Jimmy Floyd, in for Brian Lehrer. Parents of differently abled children are often put on pedestals. People wonder in awe about how they cope, or hand them platitudes about how they have to simply adjust to their dreams for their special little angels. But the parents of those children will tell you that their kids, like all kids, are not angels, and that their special challenges make life incredibly complicated, messy, and heartbreaking. With me today are two of those parents. Joining me now, Sharis Ingram and Jennifer Silverman, two moms who have contributed to the wonderful new book, My Baby Rides the Short Bus, The Unabashedly Human Experience of Raising Kids with Disabilities. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, this book is a series of essays by parents who are raising kids with disabilities. Jennifer, you are one of the editors, mm-hmm. as well as a contributor. And in the foreword of the book, you say, and I'm quoting, "My Baby Rides the Short Bus is meant as an antidote to the stories that misrepresent, ridicule, and objectify disabled kids and their parents. In this book, you'll find parents of disabled kids telling their own subjective stories with humor and grace, from a Burmese mother overcoming her physical disability as she works through her son's challenges, to a lesbian minister who becomes a foster parent and advocate, to a quirky single mama who quit school at 16. Jennifer, how many parents contributed to the book? These are essays, so how many essays are there?
So we have 37 contributors.
Wow.
And close to 40 essays.
So, and the range of disabilities is also quite great. The single mother's son had cerebral palsy, and your own 12-year-old, you write, has autism and significant developmental delays. Why did you feel the need for this book?
Well, the book is really a collaboration between myself and Yantra Bertelli and Sarah Talbot, who are the other co-editors. And we've been friends for a number of years, and we read a lot, and in the books that we were looking at, we didn't really see our experiences and our stories represented. And a lot of what we were reading, the stories had religious undertones or had a lot of platitudes or were speaking to a very privileged experience where people had unlimited resources to help their children. And then again, some stories about miracle cures and, you know, miracles didn't happen for us. And so it was really important to us to have a opportunity to showcase voices that we didn't see represented and things that we could relate to and give parents who might have also not seen their experiences and also felt somewhat marginalized by that have a platform. So
the need for the book was great, and we feel the need to take calls and hear other people's stories is just as great. So let's ask our listeners to call in. What's your own experience raising a differently abled child, whether he or she faces a mild disability or severe challenges, physical or developmental disability? We're also interested in hearing from special ed teachers and educators. 212-433-WMYC. That's 212-433-9692. Or you can post a comment at WNYC.org on Brian's page. We want to hear from any parents of special needs kids. What do you think it takes? What's the one piece of advice you would give to others? You can also answer on Facebook, where we have our Facebook page. And as I said, you can call in 212-433-WNYC. My other guest is Sharis Ingram. First and foremost, like me, a lifelong New Yorker, I could feel that New York energy when she walked into the studio. Currently lives in the Northwest Bronx. She is a stay-at-home mother and active in her community. She and her husband have two children with autistic spectrum disorders, who you write, Sharis, are nevertheless not so different than most other kids. How so? Say a little more about that.
One of the things that I found when we were going through the process of getting evaluations done and so on and so forth, because as parents, we could see that there was definitely something up, and we didn't necessarily know what that something was, but there was definitely more than just garden variety quirkiness going on with our kids. And it started with the older one. I got her the evaluation report when my younger child was 3 weeks old, and she was 3 and a half, almost 4. And all through the process, some people would come to us and say, I don't know, I don't really understand why you're doing this. She seems perfectly normal to us until all of a sudden something would happen. And it was clear that this was not something that other kids her age were doing, or she was not like the others. And so on the one hand, unlike some other parents of kids with special needs, she can kind of pass until all of a sudden she can't. And so that, on the one hand, you're grateful, and on the other hand, it presents its own challenges. People have expectations for kids, and she can't always live up to them. And the same with my son. You know, there are definitely times when she is not like the others, and yet she's, you know, if you see her at the playground, she looks like all the other kids running around.
Toward the end of your essay, which takes the form of reflections on a talk you've given to some students at a graduate level course in social work, you use the word overwhelming.
Oh, yeah.
Overwhelming.
Yes. Parenting anybody, parenting in general, that's one of the things that no parent is ever prepared for. You think you know what you're getting into, and people try and tell you, hey, you know, oh, I haven't slept, oh, this, whatever. But until you are in it, you do not know. And parenting special needs kids is even more so. It's regular parenting dialed up to 11 or 12 or 100.
Which I cannot even imagine, because regular parenting feels like it's dialed up to 11,
yeah,
to 100. I can't imagine multiplying by another 100.
Well, you do it. You what choice do you have?
Right. Eric on Facebook has some advice for parents of special needs kids. Listen to your gut and don't be afraid to fight like hell for your child. Sounds simplistic, but too many people don't follow it. Jennifer?
That's absolutely true. I used to be an introvert, and it's not possible to be that way anymore, partly because whenever we go out in public, we don't really pass. We're always a spectacle, so there's always attention that's drawn to us. But also, at the beginning of this process, when my son was first being diagnosed, he was 2 years old to 3 years old, and I was a relatively young 27-year-old parent, and this was totally outside of any experience that I'd ever had. And at first, I didn't know how to advocate. And I would hear things from doctors, and I would just kind of take them at face value and then realize that it didn't really apply. And, you know, through that process, you find your inner mama bear, and you start to learn that you have to be the best representative for your child because you are the expert on what your child's needs are.
And say a bit more about the transition. You say that you were not an extrovert. You were an introvert, diagnosing yourself. Mm-hmm. And you have two children.
Mm-hmm.
It's your older son, am I correct,
right,
who had the diagnosis. And you describe the younger child as sidekick.
Mm-hmm.
So this must have been a very, very difficult transition for you as someone who would have preferred a more private life.
Sure.
If you
Absolutely.
Don't like attention in public. So you had to come to grips with not really caring about the attention from others in public and stares and comments and all of that. Even in New York City, a place where people don't tend to pass judgment and take a second glance.
Actually, I still care a lot. And I've noticed now that as my son's older and kind of junior high age, that I tend to avoid groups with junior high kids, which I hadn't really thought about as something that I would do. But in New York, and I think this is universal to parenting everywhere, people do tell you things. They comment, they judge. They have no qualms telling you, you know, what they think, that your child's too old to be in a stroller or that, you know, your kid needs a hat, anything. And I found that people are actually, you know, in two camps. Either they tend to really ignore us and act like we're not there, or they tend to give unsolicited advice.
What should people do? I mean, obviously, I'm supposed to be objective. The unsolicited advice, I have to say, appalls me in this day and age, although I, too, have had that from strangers. But is ignoring you different somehow from minding their own business? Or is there a fine line between people just minding their own business and absolutely ignoring you?
I would just like to feel that we're welcome. I would rather have someone smile at us or ask questions, because I don't mind answering any questions. And I think that that's the way to start dialogue. And it surprised me to see how uncomfortable people are with disability in our society. So, you know, I don't stay home. I don't keep my child out of public spaces. I feel like he's part of the community, and part of my obligation as a parent is to make sure that he's involved in the fabric of the community, that he goes to places like the playground or the children's museums and has a good time, has fun. And just someone looking at us and giving us a welcoming look can make the difference between a good day or a bad day sometimes.
As for any child. Mm-hmm. Let's take a call from Wendy in Scarsdale. Wendy, you're on WMYC with Sharice.
Yes.
And Jennifer.
Yes, hi. I suppose I'm calling because when you asked if there's really any one thing, I wouldn't really say there is one thing, but for me, as an educator and a parent of children with issues, I would say to start as early as you can. And that's very difficult because if it's your first child, you often may make excuses or think, well, you know, your child is just being silly or whatnot. But I would say go with your gut. And go to your doctor. And if your doctor isn't giving you the answers you want, then move on. Because I feel that even starting at 12, 18 months, that's a perfect time. And I feel that real change could be made the earlier you start.
Well, that raises, and thank you very much, Wendy, for your call, the issue of legislation. Just yesterday, the Senate Democratic majority passed what seems to be groundbreaking legislation to protect children with autism, setting the bar for a new national standard for treatment and services. And this would require early intervention and screening, diagnosis, and treatment for autism spectrum disorders, and should save families facing autism thousands of dollars a year. At the same time, Governor Patterson has proposed sweeping cuts to early intervention and special ed as a way to address the current budget shortfall. Comments, ladies? Sharice? This is a constant tension, especially in our current economy.
It's one of the things that, you know, when there are limited funds, the weakest members of society tend to feel it the most. And this is something that I don't know how we're going to deal with this. I hope that they will reconsider this. It seems to me that the people who need the most help should be the last people who have their funding cut. But I think that this is not how things always tend to work.
Jennifer?
Well, I read the legislation about the autism insurance, and to me the language is a little vague, so I'm not entirely clear on how it's going to affect us. I think anything that gives people more coverage is definitely, you know, good and groundbreaking. And as far as cuts to things like early intervention, you know, when we first started this process, I kind of asked why the state was willing to give us these free services, because just, you know, being naturally curious and a little suspicious, I wanted to know. And I was told that the more money you put in at the beginning, the better outcome, and the less money the state has to pay for things like services for adults in the long run. And to me, that seems perfectly logical. And I can't understand why you would take money away from those services, because, you know, there's going to be a generation of adults with disabilities, autism and other disabilities. In, you know, 10, 20 years, there are going to be something like 500,000 adults with autism who may not be able to take care of themselves. So why not put the money in at, you know, this part of their intervention and give them better life skills? Because really it scares me to think that there isn't infrastructure for these kids who are going to be adults. Mm-hmm. Where are they going to live? Who's going to take care of them? And then to hear about more cuts, it makes it all the more stressful.
We need to be very forward thinking. And I think David has a comment to that point. David in Riverdale, you're on WMYC. David, are you there?
I am here.
Please go ahead. Thank you for calling. Yeah. I'm so pleased to hear from a father.
Yeah, well, I'm the father of two boys, and while they have learning disabilities as opposed to more severe disabilities, there's a couple of things I'd like to say. As you've just been talking about the financial aspect of it, my wife always says, pay for them now or pay for them later, which I think is a great way of looking at it. And we were very fortunate in that New York supported their education, and both of them are now in college. The advice that listeners are getting about advocating for their children could not be more right on. There are laws that protect children, and there are attorneys out there who this is their expertise. And a lot of parents don't know this, and schools do not really provide the information that, parents should have. I got so involved with my kids that I ended up on the board of trustees of the school that my kids attended. And it is a school for kids with learning disabilities and mild autism, and they get more than 90% of them do go to college. So I don't want people listening out there to think that this a diagnosis of a disability is something that is going to be devastating. There are lots and lots and lots of success stories.
And David, when your kids were coming up, if they're now in college, it must have been even more challenging than it is now because these diagnoses were less common.
Yeah, and it was expensive. We took them to the NYU Child Study Center and got a diagnosis and then got a very good child advocate and, in fact, fought the system. And both of my kids were funded throughout their whole education. And what's an odd thing, and this was startling to me because I was at a Board of Trustees meeting, and the director of the school the other day pointed out that, in fact, contrary to all the wisdom, that the cost of educating a kid in a school for kids with disabilities is about the same to the district when everything is considered as it is to keeping a kid in the district. Which is a startling statement to me, but he showed me the numbers, and it's very close. So it's there is this myth out there that putting kids in schools that are that for which they are best suited costs the district an extraordinary amount of money. It's just not true.
Well, David, we thank you so much for your call, and it's very, very encouraging to hear that story of the two boys in college. And another advocate for his children, Rosie in Wayne, New Jersey, calls. Rosie, yes. You're on with Sharis and Jennifer.
Yes, hi. I'm Rosie, and I have right now my son is 11 years old, and I'm a single parent raising him. And the things that I have run into is that I've been trying to find more voices to be heard on how it takes a parent such as myself to raise a child with a disability. I'm a single parent and I work, and I want that my voice to be heard. You always hear articles about the children with the disability who have these problems, but nobody really talks about the impact on the parent or a parent such as myself. And one of the things that I'm constantly been looking for every single year is an after-school program or a program to put my son in when he doesn't have school. And it's extremely difficult. The public school systems don't have anything for children with this problem. And I don't have the time to be trying to put things in place. And I think that it's wonderful that now we're starting to hear the book has been written about, what it takes parents to raise a child with a disability.
Rosie, thank you so much for your call. Again, the book is My Baby Rides the Short Bus. And Jennifer Silverman is with us. She is one of the co-editors of the book. There are three editors who met online. It's a fascinating story and became fast friends and realized there were many voices like Rosie's out there, many stories that needed to be told. But Rosie raises many issues that you raise in the book. First of all, you talk about, Jennifer, in the foreword of the book, the multicultural and cross-class issues for parents with disabilities, and yet, despite tremendous efforts, there was some difficulty in getting all of those voices into the book. And you did a tremendous job, which is why I read the quote that I read at the beginning, a really diverse panoply of essays. But say a little bit more about that. And this is fascinating, a single mother, public school setting, and of course, tremendous challenges for her.
Right. And I've been in that position. I've been a single parent. And, it's really hard to be in that situation and not have enough resources. And I was lucky to have a community that was really supportive of me at that time. But even still, you know, when you're not getting enough sleep, when you're working all the time, and when you're looking for services that aren't there or that you're on waiting lists for, that's really difficult. And in terms of the book, you know, we really wanted to represent as many points of view as possible, and we extended our calls for submissions twice to invite a more diverse group of authors to come in. But when we started to think about it, we realized that we really had the privilege of time and space and being in a partnership where we had the room to write. And, you know, when I was a single parent, I didn't have the time to do that. And I kind of take for granted that I can have my voice heard. And so, you know, if we ever did a companion piece to that, that's an area I really wish that we would represent more.
When you do the companion piece. Cindy, in Huntington, you're on WNYC.
Hi. I wanted to say that, you know, if I had to do it all over again, I would have reached out for social services earlier. My son was diagnosed with a disease called tuberous sclerosis, which can be quite devastating, but it's all along a spectrum. So some kids can be affected very mildly, but some kids can have serious developmental delays and seizures. And I think I was just in denial.
Yes.
I mean, I don't know if I would have felt differently if I had to do it all over again. But there were services available to me. One of the advocates that I'm now working with is called Skip of New York, which helps parents of disabled children keep their children at home and care for them at home. And my son, you know, is able to go to school. They're very helpful for those kids who are also very seriously disabled and can't attend school. But one of the great things that they've been able to help me do is to access the Medicaid waiver, which is my son does qualify for. And I just wish that I'd done it sooner because it provides for things like a personal attendant, which is sort of like a babysitter.
Yeah.
And I could have really used that when he was a tiny baby because it was really hard. He ended up having 2 rounds of brain surgery at NYU. And he would have totally qualified for that, but I was just in deep denial and ended up paying, you know, a Honda Civic's worth of money to a babysitter
very,
for those 2 years.
Very, very good advice for new parents. And, Sharis, I'm very tight on time,
mm-hmm.
but if you could just quickly say a little bit about the courage it takes to acknowledge the diagnosis.
Oh, yeah. I was lucky because by the time I got my daughter's evaluation, that was the first one. So when I got my son's, it was sort of like, oh, I've done this before. But when I got my daughter's evaluation, I could see the person going over the report with me about it, sort of bracing herself to give me this news. And I think she was shocked when I was so like, oh, thank God, you know what this is. You know what to do. Here, now we can get on the path to figuring it out so I'm not flailing around feeling like I'm failing my child. I'm a contributor of this book, but one of the things that I've found really useful in actually having it is the resource guide at the back. And we've done our best to be as sort of broad and inclusive and national about it as we can. But it is a really good starting place for people trying to figure out how to get the help that they need, because this is too hard to do by yourself. You really, really, really need to branch out, and it's in the best interest of your kid.
No better way to end on that note, in the best interest of the child. My guests have been Sharis Ingram and Jennifer Silverman, two moms who have contributed to this wonderful book, My Baby Rides the Short Bus. Jennifer also co-edited the book. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
I'm Jamie Floyd, in for Brian Lehrer. Up next, Billy Cohen from Time Out New York drops by with a look ahead to the summer festivals.